Welcome to the audio recording of the importance of screening for type 1 diabetes risk, what we know and where we're going. Chapter 1, State of Type 1 Diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is a chronic disease caused by autoimmune beta cell destruction that is typically characterized by absolute insulin deficiency. Although type 1 diabetes commonly presents in children and adolescents, it can develop at any age. In the United States alone, 1.4 million adults, aged 20 years and older, reported both having type 1 diabetes and needing insulin, accounting for 5.2% of all U.S. adults with diabetes. In addition, about 187,000 children in the U.S. are currently living with type 1 diabetes. An estimated 64,000 new cases of type 1 diabetes are expected to be diagnosed each year, which includes 27,000 cases in children and 37,000 cases in adults. Type 1 diabetes presents differently in children and adults. In children and adolescents, the classic presentation of type 1 diabetes involves polyuria, polydipsia, and recent unexplained weight loss. Some children may also present with atypical or nonspecific symptoms, including fatigue or weakness, dry mouth, increased appetite, blurred vision, fruity-smelling breath, nausea and vomiting, stomach pain, changes in gums, yeast infections, and bedwetting. Adults with type 1 diabetes can present with similar symptoms, but blurred vision, yeast infections, and urinary tract infections are more common in adults than in children. Adults also more frequently report tingling in hands and feet and slow healing sores. The rate of beta cell destruction is usually rapid in child onset type 1 diabetes, with an immediate time to insulin dependence. However, the rate of beta cell destruction is usually slow in adult onset type 1 diabetes, with the time to insulin dependence ranging from immediate to years. C-peptide levels are low to undetectable in children with type 1 diabetes, but can be normal early in the disease course and low to undetectable late in the disease course for adults with type 1 diabetes. Diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, is a potentially life-threatening complication of uncontrolled type 1 diabetes, and approximately 30% to 60% of children with type 1 diabetes are diagnosed while experiencing DKA. DKA at diagnosis occurs more frequently in children than in adults, likely due to the potential for rapid onset of hyperglycemia and its symptoms. Common presenting symptoms of DKA include moderate or severe dehydration, frequent vomiting, abdominal pain, polyuria despite dehydration, flushed cheeks, hyperventilation, disorientation or semi-comatose state, and shock. The biochemical criteria for a DKA diagnosis include hyperglycemia, indicated by blood glucose greater than 11 millimoles per liter or 200 milligrams per deciliter, venous pH less than 7.3 or serum bicarbonate less than 15 millimoles per liter, ketonemia or ketonuria. Although not universally available, blood beta-hydroxybutyrate concentration should be measured whenever possible. A level greater than or equal to 3 millimoles per liter is indicative of DKA. In children, type 1 diabetes and DKA may be misdiagnosed as influenza or a viral urinary tract or streptococcal infection. Similarly, adults with type 1 diabetes are frequently misdiagnosed with type 2 diabetes or another condition. In both children and adults, misdiagnosis may increase the risk of DKA or other adverse outcomes, including hyperglycemia over a prolonged period of time. In a recent study, approximately two-thirds of patients with type 1 diabetes were hospitalized at diagnosis, and 21% were admitted to the intensive care unit, or ICU, at diagnosis, primarily for DKA. Experiencing DKA at type 1 diabetes diagnosis can be traumatic for both patients and caregivers, and can have short and long-term adverse outcomes. For example, of patients admitted to the ICU at type 1 diabetes diagnosis, 25% were unconscious at the time of admission, underscoring the seriousness of the condition. and the traumatizing potential for children and adults. Furthermore, without prompt intervention, DKA can be fatal. Unsurprisingly, children presenting with DKA have been shown to have higher hemoglobin A1C levels at diagnosis. However, evidence suggests that poor glycemic control persists for up to 15 years after diagnosis. Compared with hemoglobin A1C levels in children without DKA at diagnosis, hemoglobin A1C levels were 1.4% higher in those with severe DKA and 0.9% higher in those with mild to moderate DKA at diagnosis. These effects were independent of ethnic minority status, lack of health insurance, insulin pump use, or family history of type 1 diabetes. One of the best ways to prevent DKA is to ensure prompt diagnosis and treatment of type 1 diabetes based on early recognition of symptoms and, if appropriate, autoantibody screening. Diabetes diagnostic criteria are based on blood glucose measurements, and markers are the same regardless of the patient's age or type of diabetes. These diagnostic criteria include hemoglobin A1C greater than or equal to 6.5% or 48 millimoles per mole using a laboratory standardized test. Random plasma glucose greater than or equal to 200 milligrams per deciliter or 11.1 millimoles per liter in a patient with classic symptoms of hyperglycemia or DKA. Fasting plasma glucose, or FPG, greater than or equal to 126 milligrams per deciliter or 7.0 millimoles per liter. 2-hour plasma glucose greater than or equal to 200 milligrams per deciliter or 11.1 millimoles per liter during an oral glucose tolerance test, or OGTT. Distinguishing type 1 diabetes from type 2 diabetes is critical because of the absolute requirement for treatment with insulin in type 1 diabetes. However, differentiating type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes can be challenging, particularly in adults. For patients who do not present with clear symptoms of type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes, such as adults or children recently diagnosed but with a body mass index greater than 25 kilograms per meter squared, autoantibody testing can help to differentiate the two disease states. Although the American Diabetes Association, or ADA, currently recommends islet cell autoantibody testing only in the setting of a research trial or for first-degree family members of those with type 1 diabetes, the presence of two or more autoantibodies is a near-certain indicator for future hyperglycemia and type 1 diabetes. Relevant islet cell autoantibodies include glutamic acid decarboxylase 65 kilodalton isoform, GAD65, insulin, tyrosine phosphatase, IA2A, tyrosine phosphatase IA2-beta, and zinc transporter 8. In adults, C-peptide testing may also facilitate the differentiation of type 1 diabetes from type 2 diabetes. Low levels of plasma C-peptide are indicative of little or no insulin secretion, which is characteristic of type 1 diabetes. However, C-peptide testing should not be the sole method for excluding type 2 diabetes, as C-peptide may still be detectable in early-stage type 1 diabetes. The natural history of type 1 diabetes is predictable, progressing from beta cell autoimmunity to eventual glucose intolerance and symptomatic type 1 diabetes. Clinical type 1 diabetes actually represents one of the final stages of disease, with several established pathophysiologic changes occurring before symptoms present. In 2015, a new staging system was developed to better identify type 1 diabetes in early stages, with the goal of providing a framework for future research and identifying patients who may be candidates for prevention-focused clinical trials. Type 1 diabetes is categorized into three stages according to this pathophysiologic progression, based on the presence of autoantibodies, glycemic control, and symptomatology. Stage 1 is the start of type 1 diabetes. Individuals have two or more autoantibodies and are presymptomatic and normoglycemic. At stage 2, individuals have two or more autoantibodies and are presymptomatic and dysglycemic. Stage 3 is the clinical diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. Individuals have two or more autoantibodies and are symptomatic. Prior to stage 1, the immune system attacks the beta cells, and the immune response results in the development of a single autoantibody. The presence of a single autoantibody can increase the risk of eventual development of stage 1 disease, which is more likely to occur in children younger than 5 years with initial seroconversion. Seroconversion to multiple autoantibodies typically occurs within 2 years of initial seroconversion and decreases in likelihood after 4 years have passed since the detection of a single autoantibody. Overall, the risk and rate of progression to clinical type 1 diabetes in patients with 1 or 2 autoantibodies can vary based on age at seroconversion, number of autoantibodies, autoantibody test specificity, and autoantibody titer. In general, patients with stage 1 disease have a 44% risk of developing type 1 diabetes within 5 years and a 70% risk of developing type 1 diabetes within 10 years. Patients with stage 2 type 1 diabetes have an approximately 75% risk of developing symptomatic type 1 diabetes within 5 years. Their lifetime risk of developing symptomatic type 1 diabetes is 100%. Doctors McVean and Shubrook now describe how they would assess a symptomatic patient with undiagnosed type 1 diabetes for DKA.
So when a patient comes into your office with presumptive new onset type 1 diabetes, the first thing that needs to be done is to rule out diabetic ketoacidosis, as we know that diabetic ketoacidosis is a life-threatening emergency. Typically, you're going to begin with a point of care glucose. And if that glucose is over 200 with the classic signs and symptoms of type 1 diabetes, such as polyuria, polydipsia, weight loss, that confirms the diagnosis. The next step is to get a basic metabolic panel to look for diabetic ketoacidosis. What we're looking for is an anion gap metabolic acidosis. Dr. Shubrook, what does that look like in your primary care office?
Well, so many of our patients who present with new onset type 1 may already go to the emergency room, but I really think what you stressed is really important, that if your patient presents with polys and the weight loss, that it's really important for us to have a sense of getting a glucose first, because that's a really important decision point. And if that glucose is significantly elevated in someone without a history of diabetes, unless you have the ability to do in-office testing, you really need to get the patient to get emergency care, because this is really something that's going to make a major difference in this initial presentation.
Chapter 2, Type 1 Diabetes Autoantibody Screening, Tests, and Follow-Up. Because the pathophysiologic processes leading to clinical type 1 diabetes begin before symptom onset, research-based type 1 diabetes screening programs have been developed to identify asymptomatic individuals who have a high risk of developing type 1 diabetes. These screening programs are important for proactively identifying individuals who are candidates for prevention-focused clinical trials and for helping family members and caregivers to promptly recognize type 1 diabetes symptoms and mentally prepare for lifestyle changes required for a person with insulin dependence. Because type 1 diabetes has been attributed to a complex interplay of genetics and environment, the incidence of type 1 diabetes is higher in individuals who have first-degree relatives with the disease. In the general population, the risk of type 1 diabetes for persons aged up to 20 years is about 0.3%, compared with 5% for those who have a first-degree relative with type 1 diabetes, representing an approximately 15-fold increase in risk. Similarly, the lifetime risk of developing type 1 diabetes is 1% in people who do not have a first-degree relative with type 1 diabetes, compared with 10% to 20% in first-degree relatives. In addition, researchers have identified more than 60 genetic variants that can increase type 1 diabetes risk. Specific variants in the human leukocyte antigen, or HLA gene, are the primary genetic driver of risk and can increase the risk of type 1 diabetes by up to 30-fold. Other genes associated with an increased risk of type 1 diabetes include those that encode for other immune system components, such as IL-2RA and CTLA-4. Despite the established genetic contributors to type 1 diabetes, an estimated 93% of patients with type 1 diabetes have no known family history. Indeed, the global incidence of type 1 diabetes has increased over the last 30 years, whereas the proportion of patients with high-risk HLA haplotypes has decreased. These data underscore the role of environmental factors in type 1 diabetes development and progression. Other possible triggers that may increase type 1 diabetes risk include the following. Enteroviral infection during childhood. Maternal enteroviral infection, infant diet, decreased gut microbiome diversity, and rapid weight gain during infancy. Over the past decade, evidence supports the utility of type 1 diabetes screening in identifying individuals who will develop type 1 diabetes. In a pooled analysis of more than 13,000 children from the Colorado DAISY study, the Finnish DIP study, and the German baby diab and baby diet studies, the majority of children with two or more islet autoantibodies progressed to type 1 diabetes within 15 years. In this analysis, all children were assessed for autoantibodies to insulin, GAD65 and IA2, and progression to type 1 diabetes was monitored. For children who tested positive for two or more autoantibodies, 69.7% progressed to type 1 diabetes within 10 years. Furthermore, 14.5% of those who tested positive for a single autoantibody progressed to type 1 diabetes within 10 years. In contrast, the prevalence of type 1 diabetes in children with no autoantibodies was 0.4% by age 15 years. Among those with multiple autoantibodies, children younger than 3 years with autoantibody seroconversion, those with high-risk HLA genotypes, and girls had more rapid progression to type 1 diabetes than others. More recently, the FRIDA study, which was conducted in Germany, showed that primary care screening of children aged 2 to 5 years resulted in an islet autoantibody prevalence rate of 0.31%. In total, more than 90,000 children were screened in this study. Of the 280 with presymptomatic type 1 diabetes, 196, or 0.22%, were diagnosed with stage 1, 17, or 0.02%, with stage 2, and 26, or 0.03%, with stage 3. Within 2.4 years of follow-up, 36 more children progressed to stage 3 type 1 diabetes, resulting in a 24.9% 3-year risk of type 1 diabetes in children with autoantibody positivity. In this population, the prevalence of DKA was less than 5%. In contrast, previous studies of DKA rates in 47,000 children and adolescents in 25 countries showed that the prevalence of DKA varied from nearly 15% in Denmark to nearly 80% in Saudi Arabia. These results align with those of older studies, including DAISY and TEDDY, which showed that the prevalence of DKA at diagnosis was substantially lower in children who underwent autoantibody screening than it was in the general population. A common question among patients, caregivers, and clinicians is related to the stability of autoantibody seroconversion. In the TEDDY study, the frequency of autoantibody reversion was assessed in nearly 600 children aged 10 years or younger who had at least one positive autoantibody. Reversion from positive to negative was reported in 19% of children with autoantibodies to GAD65 and in 29% of those with autoantibodies to insulin. However, this phenomenon was primarily restricted to children with single autoantibodies. Fewer than 1% of children with multiple autoantibodies experienced autoantibody reversion. For children who did experience reversion, it primarily occurred within 2 years of seroconversion and was more common in those with lower titers and lower-risk HLA genotypes. Nonetheless, the risk of type 1 diabetes remained elevated for children who reverted relative to those who never had autoantibody seroconversion. Specifically, children who never developed autoantibodies, 0.06 per 100 person years. Children who reverted from single autoantibody positive to autoantibody negative, 0.14 per 100 person years. Children who remain single autoantibody positive, 1.8 per 100 person years. In the future, autoantibody testing may be combined with additional biomarkers to improve sensitivity and specificity for type 1 diabetes. In a study of 1,244 patients with type 1 diabetes, at least one autoantibody, and no known family history, a genetic risk score, or GRS, was developed to calculate the risk of progression to clinical type 1 diabetes. When combined with autoantibody status and diabetes prevention trial, type 1 or DPT1 risk score, the GRS was a strong predictor of progression to type 1 diabetes. The DPT1 risk score is a diabetes risk score derived from islet cell autoantibody positive individuals and validated in TrialNet that combines BMI, age, glucose, and C-peptide. Investigation into the development and validation of type 1 diabetes risk scores is ongoing, and future type 1 diabetes prediction studies may incorporate these biomarkers into clinical trial enrollment and monitoring criteria. TrialNet is a research-based screening and clinical trial program intended for individuals who have a higher risk of developing type 1 diabetes based on family history or previous autoantibody testing. In contrast, T1 Detect is an education and awareness program to expand type 1 diabetes screening among the general population. Individuals are not required to have a family member with type 1 diabetes to be screened through T1 Detect using the type 1 diabetes autoantibody detection panel. Because the majority of type 1 diabetes cases are sporadic, T1 Detect will help increase the number of people who can be screened and receive early indications of their risk of developing type 1 diabetes. A physician referral is not needed to get screened using the autoantibody detection panel, but it is strongly recommended that individuals follow up with their healthcare providers upon receiving their results. Both programs offer in-home type 1 diabetes autoantibody tests, and both have distinct testing criteria, costs, and autoantibodies included in their panels. For example, the T1 Detect screening currently includes autoantibodies IAA, GAD, and IA2A. Additional antibodies will be included in the future. The TrialNet screening includes GAD and MIAA. Individuals who test positive for GAD and MIAA are tested for ICA, IA2A, and zinc transporter 8. Individuals who are interested in and can afford the test can get a T1 Detect test. A physician referral or order is not needed to request a test. Alternatively, the TrialNet test is available to individuals who have not been diagnosed with diabetes and who are between the ages of 2.5 and 45 years and have a first-degree relative with type 1 diabetes. Between the ages of 2.5 and 20 years and have a second-degree relative with type 1 diabetes. Or individuals who have tested positive for at least one type 1 diabetes autoantibody outside of TrialNet. The cost of the T1 Detect screening test is $55 plus sales tax. It can be subsidized to an out-of-pocket cost of $10 for those with financial hardship. The cost of the TrialNet screening test is free. Patients with negative results can retest with T1 Detect, but cannot retest with TrialNet. For both programs, test kits are delivered via mail, and a simple finger prick is used to collect drops of blood. The blood samples are then packaged with provided materials and sent to a centralized laboratory for testing. For individuals who are uncomfortable with an in-home finger prick or who prefer to be tested in a laboratory setting, the screening kit from TrialNet can be taken to a Quest Diagnostics or LabCorp for blood sample collection. Additional information about T1 Detect can be found at the website www.jdrf.org/T1D-resources/T1Detect. Additional information about TrialNet can be found at the website www.trialnet.org/participate. Patients considering type 1 diabetes screening should be informed of the benefits of testing, as well as the inherent limitations of autoantibody screening. Benefits include: provides patients, family, and caregivers with the opportunity to learn about type 1 diabetes and lifestyle modifications required for those with insulin dependence. Creates an opportunity for education about common signs and symptoms, which may in turn prevent the trauma of DKA and hospitalization. In the TEDDY study, for example, the risk of DKA was reduced by 2- to 3-fold over population-based registries. Facilitates participation in clinical trials intended to prevent or delay type 1 diabetes onset. Limitations include: increases psychological distress in parents and caregivers at time of diagnosis, which can be addressed with education and counseling. May not change outcomes because of the current lack of U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA-approved, commercially available treatments to slow or prevent type 1 diabetes. Additionally, common symptoms of type 1 diabetes to discuss with patients and/or parents and caregivers include polyuria, polydipsia, recent unexplained weight loss, fatigue or weakness, dry mouth, increased appetite, blurred vision, fruity-smelling breath, nausea, vomiting, or stomach pain, changes in gums, urinary tract or yeast infections, and bedwetting. After an individual undergoes autoantibody screening, next steps depend on the presence and number of autoantibodies. Evidence-based guidance for the follow-up and monitoring of patients after type 1 diabetes autoantibody screening is currently in development and not yet available. The best practice suggestions provided here are based on expert opinion, but a lack of consensus still exists among experts. It is suggested that any positive screening test result be confirmed within 2 to 6 weeks. If patients are autoantibody negative, it is suggested that they be rescreened if they are symptomatic. It is also suggested that they be rescreened at age 5 years if younger than 5 years at first screen, or at 11 years if aged 5 to 10 years at first screen. If patients are single autoantibody positive and have normal glycemic control or a hemoglobin A1c less than 5.7%, then follow-up in 6 months is suggested to exclude diagnosis and repeat metabolic testing, such as OGTT, fasting blood glucose, and random blood glucose. Yearly follow-up is suggested for patients who are single autoantibody positive for 2 years. If patients are at stage 1 type 1 diabetes, meaning they are multiple autoantibody positive and have normal glycemic control indicated by a hemoglobin A1c less than 5.7%, then follow-up in 6 months is suggested to exclude diagnosis and repeat metabolic testing, such as OGTT, fasting blood glucose, and random blood glucose. Patients also need to be advised to call immediately if any symptoms present. If patients are at stage 2 type 1 diabetes, meaning they are multiple autoantibody positive and have dysglycemia, then it is suggested that they receive early type 1 diabetes education and check fasting and 2-hour post-largest meal blood glucose once a week. They can use continuous glucose monitor or strips. If their blood glucose is greater than 200 milligrams per deciliter, then they need to follow up with a pediatric endocrinologist immediately. Follow-up in 3 months is suggested to exclude diagnosis, repeat antibody and metabolic testing, such as OGTT, fasting blood glucose, and random blood glucose. If patients are at stage 3 type 1 diabetes, meaning that they are multiple autoantibody positive and symptomatic, then it is suggested that they are assessed for polyuria, polydipsia, weight loss, fatigue, and DKA. Patients likely need to start insulin that day. A local pediatric endocrinologist needs to be contacted for specific follow-up. For all patients who are multiple autoantibody positive, rescreening and excluding the diagnosis is suggested, which includes using the following tests: confirmatory autoantibody test, hemoglobin A1C, blood glucose, urine ketones, and OGTT. Patients who test positive for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies can also be referred to an existing screening program such as TrialNet. In addition to TrialNet, there are local screening programs through which individuals may be initially screened for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies, or to which individuals who have tested positive for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies may be referred. The ASK, or Autoimmunity Screening for Kids, research program is based at the University of Colorado and offers free autoantibody screening to all Colorado children ages 1 to 17 years and their parents for type 1 diabetes and celiac disease. The PRIMED, or Precision Individualized Medicine for Diabetes program at the University of Virginia, provides genetic screening for type 1 diabetes risk for children living in Virginia, followed by autoantibody testing in high genetic risk patients. The PLEDGE, or Population Level Estimate of Type 1 Diabetes Risk Genes in Children, program offers genetic screening for type 1 diabetes risk for all children younger than age 6 years who are patients at Sanford Health, which is based in South Dakota with sites in 26 states. Individuals with a high genetic risk also then undergo autoantibody testing. The CASCADE, or Combined Antibody Screening for Celiac and Diabetes Evaluation Program, is based at the Pacific Northwest Research Institute and provides genetic screening for type 1 diabetes risk and celiac disease of all newborns in Washington, followed by autoantibody testing in individuals with a high genetic risk. For more information about these local screening programs, go to the following websites. For ASK, go to www.askhealth.org. For PRIMED, go to https://sif.virginia.edu/PRIMED. For PLEDGE, go to https://research.sanfordhealth.org/fields-of-research/diabetes/pledge. For CASCADE, go to https://cascadekids.org/. For individuals who have been screened for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies, several resources are available. For continued monitoring and participation in type 1 diabetes research and clinical trials, go to www.trialnet.org and www.trialnet.org/participate. For valuable type 1 diabetes information and support, go to www.jdrf.org/t1d-resources. For support through JDRF's Type 1 Diabetes Connections Program or online diabetes support team, go to www.jdrf.org/t1d-resources/personal-support. For specialized mental health support and counseling for patients with early stage type 1 diabetes, go to https://professional.diabetes.org/MHP_listing. Doctors McVean and Shubrook now discuss next steps after a patient is tested positive for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies.
So your patient got the in-home screening test for type 1 diabetes risk, and they're coming back to your office now for results. And so I think it's important to remember that this is new information and can be really overwhelming for both you and the patient and their family. So initially, the first step would be take an assessment of where they're at right now. What is their glucose at the time? What is their A1C? And what knowledge have they already gained? it's important for us to identify where they're at in their diabetes spectrum so that we can give them the best information and timely treatment. So as we think about these different parameters that we're looking at, Jen, how would we stage someone with potentially a staging of diabetes when they get these results and they're coming back to the office?
Well, the first thing we want to do is to look for stage 3 type 1 diabetes, which is the stage of diabetes that requires insulin immediately. We'll need to rule out diabetic ketoacidosis with a basic metabolic panel. If the patient has diabetic ketoacidosis, they'll need to go to an emergency room immediately. Even if the patient doesn't have diabetic ketoacidosis, they'll need to start insulin likely that day. Now, if a patient has stage 2 type 1 diabetes, this is multiple antibody positive and abnormal glucose tolerance, these patients will need to be educated about the signs and symptoms of DKA and what to look for when they know that they're going to need insulin. These patients will require close follow-up every 3 to 6 months. You'll be looking at things like hemoglobin A1C, self-monitoring of blood glucose, oral glucose tolerance test. Stage 1 type 1 diabetes is multiple autoantibody positive, but normal glucose tolerance. It will be a little bit longer typically for these patients before they require insulin. They also should be educated about the signs and symptoms of DKA. Their follow-up will include hemoglobin A1C, oral glucose tolerance test. Their follow-up tends to be every 6 to 12 months. It's important for all of these patients to know that if they notice a change in anything, drinking more, urinating more, losing weight, they need to be in contact with you immediately. It's also important for all of these patients to provide resources. This is really overwhelming for the patient and their families. They may want to be involved in clinical trials. Giving them resources such as JDRF, as well as the American Diabetes Association, are also extremely helpful.
Chapter 3, A Family's Experience with Type 1 Diabetes Autoantibody Testing. Although type 1 diabetes autoantibody testing may increase psychological distress in some parents and caregivers, others want to know their child's results. Anne, who had no previous family history of type 1 diabetes, describes her family's experiences beginning when her two young sons were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. After her second son's diagnosis, her family decided to participate in TrialNet, through which her daughter and third son were tested for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies. Her third son tested positive for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies and later developed type 1 diabetes. But Anne and her family knew which diabetes symptoms to look for, preventing a traumatic type 1 diabetes diagnosis.
Hi, my name is Anne, and I have three sons with type 1 diabetes. Our first son, Mason's diagnosis, was a complete surprise. We had no family history of type 1 diabetes. We knew something was wrong and took him to the pediatrician. I had a friend in college who developed diabetes, so I knew the symptoms and asked the pediatrician to test for it. For reasons I still don't understand, he sent blood work out to a lab instead of just checking his urine. By the time we got to the hospital the next day, Mason was in DKA. His blood sugar was over 900. He was dying. I'll never forget the feeling of drinking from a fire hose, trying to absorb all the information I would need to keep my child alive when we went home from the hospital. We knew that the other children had a chance of getting it, but really didn't think it would happen again. But 9 years later, I accidentally gave all the kids a glucose tolerance test. We were at a Rome Braves game and it was incredibly hot. I bought each of the kids a frozen lemonade. Mason noted that it had 103 grams of sugar in it, and he wasn't sure he had enough insulin in his pump to cover it. When we left the stadium, William needed to stop by the restroom before we went to the car. And then he needed to stop again before we made it to the expressway. We had to stop for him every 15 minutes on the way home. When we arrived home, I tested his blood sugar with Mason's meter. The reading was HI. Over 700, too high to read. I tested again using a backup meter and got the same result. I called the endocrinologist and asked her how much insulin to give him and when she would like to see him. No hospital, no IVs, no DKA. We then entered TrialNet, and the other four of us got tested. Forrester came back with 3 positive antibodies. He immediately went to the endocrinologist for a glucose tolerance test and some other testing that showed us that he did not yet have symptomatic T1D. From then on, I just randomly checked his blood sugar. One morning in August of 2008, when he was 15 years old, I tested him when I woke him up for school, and he was 245. Anything over 140 is indicative of diabetes. He went on to school, and I called the endocrinologist for an appointment. Again, no hospital, no IVs, no DKA. I won't say no drama. We've always wanted to help further diabetes research in any way we could. So after William's diagnosis, we were told about TrialNet, and we wanted to participate. Partly, we wanted some relief. I think we hoped that we would all be cleared and we could relax a little bit. We knew that it could be a burden to know that Forrester or Virginia had antibodies, but we were willing to take on that burden if it provided a stepping stone to a cure. When Forrester's test result came back with 3 positive autoantibodies, we were pretty bummed out. At the time, they didn't know that the disease had begun and he was in stage 1. I was desperate to do anything I could to change his diet or his environment or whatever it took to stave off the diabetes. It felt like my teenage son was going out into a minefield every day. Simple decisions about things like the flu shot became monumental. Would the shot or the flu be more likely to trigger his immune system? Now that we know that antibodies mean that you already have T1D, I think you can feel more in control. You can be proactive about engaging in clinical trials and in educating your family and caretakers in looking for the warning signs of T1D. I think the T1 Detect program is going to be so awesome. 85% of the people who have T1D or diagnosed with it have no family history of it, just like our family when Mason was diagnosed. I know from visiting with the people in the hospital that look of sheer terror that you have to remember everything they tell you and that they're going to send you home with your child on life support and it's up to you to keep them alive. For families to have a little more time, a little more education before they get that diagnosis will just be such a tremendous help.
Chapter 4, A Patient's Experience with Type 1 Diabetes Misdiagnosis. Adults with type 1 diabetes are frequently misdiagnosed as having type 2 diabetes. Kylene describes her experiences of being misdiagnosed with type 2 diabetes at the age of 29 and how autoantibody testing helped to later confirm her type 1 diabetes diagnosis.
My name is Kylene, and at age 29, I was misdiagnosed with type 2 diabetes, later to find out that I should have been diagnosed as type 1. When I was diagnosed, it was after several hospital visits due to pancreatitis and a few episodes of DKA. I was finally diagnosed correctly, which then began my journey, a long journey at that. Another doctor friend of mine actually was the one that suggested to my on-call physician that they test me for type 1 diabetes. After she and I were holding a couple of conversations about the different symptoms that I was experiencing, how long I was experiencing them, and just some other things, she decided to reach out to my on-call doctor and suggest the antibody testing. And that was how we determined that I was actually misdiagnosed. Being misdiagnosed caused unnecessary hospital stays, time wasted with incorrect medication, and stress. Of course, I was frustrated, knowing that you are doing everything your doctor has told you to do, but you're still getting sick. I'm still ending up in the hospital, and no one can give me answers as to why this is happening. Finding out that T1D was actually the diagnosis that I had, I didn't really have too many emotions at the time. I didn't know what T1D was. I just was relieved that I had the correct diagnosis and that it was just something that I was going to have to get familiar with, and that it was a lifelong autoimmune disease. My emotions were simply being relieved to be diagnosed correctly. I don't have any feelings toward taking incorrect meds. I'm someone who suffers with chronic asthma and chronic coughing. So trying different medications and things like that was something that I was used to. The frustration was just honestly not having the correct diagnosis, knowing that something was wrong and not knowing what it was and how to fix it. I think it's very important to listen to patients or caregivers about the symptoms that they are having and run tests based off of symptoms, not age, weight, or ethnic background. I struggled with pancreatitis and DKA, and I did not have to. Because my appearance outweighed what I was saying, I now have to take medication daily for pancreatitis, something that I should not have to do. I went to therapy because I was so frustrated, and I assumed I was the one doing something wrong with managing my diabetes. Thankfully, I did not suffer financially. However, that's not the outcome for others. The mental aspect of beating yourself up because you're assuming you aren't doing the right things and managing your diabetes is hard, very hard.
Chapter 5, Why Patients Without a Family History of Type 1 Diabetes May Consider Autoantibody Testing. Approximately 93% of individuals diagnosed with type 1 diabetes do not have a family history of type 1 diabetes. Hannah explains why she decided to order an in-home screening test for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies.
My name is Hannah, and I'm 22 years old, and I have no relatives or any family history with type 1 or type 2 diabetes. I'm interested in screening for T1D even though I do not have a family history because I've become extremely aware of everything that goes into T1D management since I started dating my girlfriend who has lived with T1D since she was 11. She also had no previous family history of T1D, and so when she started experiencing symptoms, her family wasn't even aware that diabetes could be a possibility. Hearing her and her family talk about how scary the diagnosis was and how if she hadn't been diagnosed when she was, what the consequences would have been, was what sparked my interest in getting screened myself when I heard about the opportunity. And I would describe the process of being screened for T1D as an incredibly simple and not as daunting as it sounds. The at-home test was very well explained, and even though I don't have any medical experience, I felt totally comfortable completing the screening at home. I'm not a big fan of needles, but pricking my finger was a lot easier and a lot less painful than I thought it would be. The instructions were super clear, and it was not difficult at all to get the amount of blood needed for the test. And I have connected with others about the test who also don't have any family experience with T1D. And I've only had one person who was hesitant at the idea of themselves getting tested, and that was actually my mom. She was diagnosed with another autoimmune disorder called Addison's disease a few years ago, and she has fears that T1 antibodies could show up in her tests and that would create anxiety for her. In her case, she just believes that ignorance is bliss, but I think it's better to know and be prepared, you know, just in case. I believe this is a program that more people who don't have any connection to type 1 diabetes will be interested in as more people gain awareness. And, you know, and obviously it's a bit nerve-wracking to be screened for type 1 because there is a fear of it coming back and being positive for antibodies. But the way I see it, it's better to know what to look for symptoms-wise and be prepared than not having any idea at all, particularly for people like me who don't have a family history of diabetes.
Chapter 6, Emerging Therapies to Slow Type 1 Diabetes Progression. One of the major benefits of diagnosing early stage 1 diabetes is the opportunity to participate in prevention-focused clinical trials. Research is ongoing to identify agents that may slow or prevent type 1 diabetes progression, primarily with the use of agents that have been shown to dampen the immune response. Evidence from past trials suggests that a window of opportunity may exist in type 1 diabetes, and the early administration of disease-modifying therapies may be crucial to slowing the progression of autoimmunity. Teplizumab is an anti-CD3 monoclonal antibody that has been shown to delay type 1 diabetes progression. In a recent phase 2 study of teplizumab, 76 individuals with a high risk of type 1 diabetes based on family history and multiple autoantibody positivity were randomized to receive daily infusions of teplizumab or placebo for 14 days. After a median follow-up of approximately 2 years, type 1 diabetes was diagnosed in 43% of the teplizumab group and 72% of the placebo group. Furthermore, median time to type 1 diabetes diagnosis was almost doubled in the teplizumab group, 48.4 months for teplizumab compared with 24.4 months for placebo. Adverse effects reported in individuals given teplizumab included rash and transient lymphopenia. In a follow-up extension of the phase 2 trial for a median time of approximately 2.5 years, the median time to diagnosis in the teplizumab group was 59.6 months compared with 27.1 months in the placebo group. Demonstrating that teplizumab delayed progression to type 1 diabetes by almost 3 years. A biologics license application for teplizumab has been filed with the FDA for priority review. TrialNet currently has two other ongoing studies for the prevention of type 1 diabetes. Abatacept is a co-stimulation modulator approved for use in other autoimmune conditions that is being evaluated in participants with stage 1 type 1 diabetes to prevent progression to stages 2 and 3. In a previous study, abatacept was shown to increase insulin production by 59% in patients with newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes. To expand on this success, TrialNet developed the abatacept prevention study, which is evaluating 12 months of abatacept treatment against placebo. Hydroxychloroquine is also under investigation for the delay of type 1 diabetes. Hydroxychloroquine is an antimalarial used in the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. In contrast with patients in the teplizumab and abatacept trials, patients in the hydroxychloroquine prevention study will take hydroxychloroquine on an ongoing basis until disease progression. The hydroxychloroquine prevention study is currently enrolling patients with stage 1 type 1 diabetes. For patients recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, studies are ongoing to determine whether the progression of type 1 diabetes may be slowed. In an early phase 3 study of teplizumab in children and adults with recent onset type 1 diabetes, which is defined as less than or equal to 12 weeks since diagnosis, teplizumab did not reduce insulin use or hemoglobin A1c levels relative to placebo in the overall study population. However, in a subgroup analysis, teplizumab appeared to be more effective very early after diagnosis and in children. This subgroup analysis formed the basis for the study design of the Phase 3 PROTECT trial, which is enrolling children aged 8 to 17 years who have been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in the previous 6 weeks. In the PROTECT study, participants will receive 2 courses of either teplizumab or placebo. Similarly, in the Phase 3 CLEVER trial, patients with newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes will be randomized according to 2 treatment types. 1. A hybrid closed-loop insulin pump system or no hybrid closed-loop system. And 2. Verapamil or placebo for a total of 4 trial groups. The results of CLEVER expected in 2022 and the results of PROTECT are expected in 2023. Lastly, the TOPPLE study is currently enrolling adults who have been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes within the last 4 years for a safety study of the plasmid vector NNC0361-0041, which is hypothesized to prevent patients' immune systems from attacking their beta cells. Please note that abatacept, hydroxychloroquine, teplizumab, verapamil, and NNC0361-0041 are currently not FDA approved for the delay or prevention of type 1 diabetes in individuals at risk of developing type 1 diabetes or for the delay of type 1 diabetes progression in individuals with new onset type 1 diabetes. Doctors McVean and Shubrook now provide general information for patients who are interested in enrolling in a clinical trial, including what they can expect when participating in a clinical trial.
So one of the things that we'll be able to share with our patients who have autoantibodies testing that's positive is there is a number of clinical trials that are available for patients and sometimes their families. And this is really a wonderful resource that we want to be able to share within our offices. Now, you don't need to be an expert in all these clinical trials. It's really important to be able to know where you could go to send patients so they can get more information. And certainly, JDRF is an excellent resource, both nationally and regionally, to get information for both patients and their family to know what they have access to. We also have clinicaltrials.gov, which is a national repository of clinical research trials. And you can search by disease type, you can actually also search by region, and you can really get information relevant to where you're at, both in the disease process, but also where you're at geographically. And then it's really important to know that in these clinical trials, we're trying to find ways to help patients take steps to change the progression from stage 1 or stage 2 diabetes to prevent stage 3 diabetes, and particularly diabetic ketoacidosis. This can be a major source of excitement and hope, both for the patient and, of course, for the population. Clinical trials are not always a simple equation, though. So, Jen, what are some of the things that we should communicate with our families who are considering a clinical trial?
Great question. Well, first of all, patients often haven't been a part of a clinical trial. So what should they expect? The first thing to know is that there are inclusion and exclusion criteria for specific trials. A patient may want to participate in a particular trial, but they may or may not be eligible for that trial. There are going to be some extra appointments involved and perhaps even some travel. Good for patients to find out how many appointments. Can some of those be done remotely? Is there extra compensation for travel? Now, the other thing that's important to know is that some trials directly benefit the participant, whereas others are really more to learn about the disease state, about the disease process. It's important for participants to know the particular trial that they're interested in. Does it directly benefit them? Or is it just to learn about the disease state in general? Another important thing to explain to patients is that in clinical trials, there's often randomization. Some patients get the usual care and some patients get the experimental treatment. This is the way that we find out if these new treatments are working better than our standard treatment. It's also important for them to know that research is voluntary. They may be interested in participating in it, they may not be. And the care that you're going to provide to them as their primary care provider is going to be the same regardless if they decide to participate in clinical trial or not. And it's also important for patients to know that they can enter a study, and if for some reason they decide they want to exit the study, that's also an option for them as well. I think the big thing for them to know is that the clinical trials are out there, and that if they're interested in participating, that it's an option.
For those who have been screened for type 1 diabetes autoantibodies, several resources are available, including JDRF Find a Clinical Trial at the website www.jdrf.org/impact/research/clinical-trials. TrialNet Prevention Studies at the website www.trialnet.org/our-research/prevention-studies. TrialNet newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes studies at the website www.trialnet.org/our-research/newly-diagnosed-T1D. A database containing all clinical trials is available at clinicaltrials.gov. Please also see the online activity for the list of references cited in this activity.